Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and today I'm going to continue where I left off last week, continuing with the testament of the Irish political prisoner, hunger striker, Bobby Sands, and his testament, One Day in My Life, which I began last week about this testament of his experience in just, one of the many, many days he spent. You know, he was in jail for years in a British jail in Northern Ireland. And he was 27 years old. Bobby Sands was 27 years old and had been on hunger strike for 66 days when he died on May 5th, 1981. And the young IRA volunteer was world famous by the time of his death, having spent the last 9 years of his short life in prison, and had been elected while still a prisoner to the British Parliament. The hunger strike was aimed at rebutting the British government's attempts to criminalize the struggle for Irish freedom by changing Sands and his fellow cellmates' status from political to criminal. While behind bars, Sands secretly wrote on toilet paper and cigarette papers with a refill of a cheap pen that he kept hidden inside his body. These writings were then smuggled out of the prison. With dry humor, they chart a man's attempt to preserve his identity against appalling beatings, unimaginable filth, freezing cold, and numbing boredom. In poetry and prose, he vividly evokes the enclosed hell of Longkesh prison, the harassment, and the humiliating invasive searches. And his writings from prison stand as a testament to the political prisoners' courage and their indomitable struggle for recognition and freedom. So this is why I'm reading this. It's heavy stuff. Like a day in my life is not a easy thing to read. That is not an easy piece of writing to read, but I still think it's important. This is also in solidarity with Hadar Adnan, you know, the Palestinian man who died in an Israeli prison earlier this month, on the 2nd of May, 2023, after 85 days on hunger strike. It really is in solidarity with him and other Palestinians who have stood up to the occupation of their land, and who refuse to be criminalized, refuse to be denigrated, refuse to be beaten or broken down. And it's really in solidarity with them that I'm reading this right now, that I'm reading this this piece by Bobby Sands, and of course the Irish freedom struggle and the Palestinian freedom struggle have been joined, you know, for a long time. There's been a lot of solidarity between them. Those resisting British occupation in Northern Ireland and those resisting Israeli occupation in Palestine. You know, there's been a long history of solidarity there going back many decades. And certainly Bobby Sands himself, you know, would definitely want there to be recognition of the Palestinian struggle and for his writings to reinforce that struggle, you know, like for there to be solidarity there. So that's why I'm going to continue doing this today. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR as I continue reading from Bobby Sands, A Day in My Life. I rose slowly from the mattress, testing every movement. I made it to my feet and placed the mattress against the wall. I spread a blanket on the floor with another blanket wrapped around my waist and a towel around my head and shoulders. I set off once again like a nomad on my journey to nowhere. It was still cold, but the morning bite had gone from the air. The snow lay heavy on the ground outside, and the light was unusually dim for midday. The dinner will be here shortly, I thought. And then it's only a few hours to my visit. The thought of seeing my family was comforting. It was the highlight and only highlight of each long, torturous month. 12 highlights per year. Half an hour of comparative happiness each visit. That's 6 hours of comparative happiness a year. I did a quick bit of mental arithmetic. That's 6 hours out of 8,760 per year. 6 lousy hours, and they harass you and your family for every minute of it. Every single minute of it. I walked on, anger beginning to surge up inside me. Bastards, I said, and stopped to gaze out of the open but concrete-barred window. I won't have this much longer either, I reminded myself, thinking of how they'd started to block up the windows in the other wings with corrugated iron and timber, blocking out all sunlight and the sky. There wasn't much to see anyway except the birds, the night sky, and the clouds. The rest was just a downright depressing eyesore, although at present the snow was unusual and it hung on the miles of ugly, gruesome barbed wire and clung to the impersonal, usually depressing, corrugated iron. Everything was either a dreary gray or a brilliant white. At night, there would be a bit of color while the snow lasted, with the thousands of assorted bright lights and beaming spotlights reflecting on the white carpet. Wouldn't it be a relief and a delight to stroll through a lush green field and touch the blades of shining grass and feel the fresh texture of a leaf on a tree, or sit on a hill and gaze upon a valley filled with the buzzing life of spring, smelling the fresh, clean, healthy scent with nothing but miles of space around me. Freedom. That was it. Freedom to live again. I turned from the window to continue my relentless pacing, disheartened a little by the thoughts of freedom. I looked at the stinking, dirt-covered walls, the piles of disease-ridden rubbish and decaying waste food that lay scattered in the corners on the damp floor, the mutilated, filthy mattress torn to shreds by a thousand searches, the tea-stained ceiling to cut the glare reflecting off the bright light, the scraped and scarred door, the disease-ridden chamber pot that lay beside the door. It was getting harder and harder to conjure up the picture of that beautiful lush green field. Every minute my nightmarish surroundings screamed at me. There was no escaping this nightmare unless I gave up. A few, very few, had already given up. They had put on prison clothes and conformed. Not that they had wished to do this. They just couldn't bear the unrelenting burden of torture, the continued boredom, tension and fear, the deprivation of basic necessities like exercise and fresh air, no association with other human beings except through a shout from behind a closed, heavy steel door. The depression, the beatings, the cold. What is there? I said to myself. Look out the window in concentration camp and concentration camp screams at you. Look around you in the tomb that you survive in and you are engulfed in hell with little black devils in the forms of A, B, and C ready to pounce on you each minute of each stinking nightmare-ridden day. I pulled my mattress back to its former position on the floor and sat down. The first clouds of depression fell upon me. I tried to think of my coming visit to cheer myself up. I thought of Pee-wee, and I was about to kill B and C in another fantasy when a cheer arose announcing the arrival of the long-awaited dinner. The Happy Wagon, as they called the lorry that brought the food from the cookhouse to the H blocks, had arrived. And thank God for that, I thought, forgetting the threatening depression. There was a bit of buzz in the wing, as signs of life suddenly appeared from within the tombs around me. A few of the lads went to the windows and a bit of chatter ensued. The arrival of the dinner did not only mean food. It also meant that the screws would be departing shortly for their two-hour-long dinner break. It meant comparative safety for 2 short hours, and it also meant that you would only have half a day left to battle with. A slight drizzle of rain fell outside. I hoped to God it wouldn't rain heavily, for if the snow melted, they'd be out with the hoses, hosing the outside of the cells and the yards. That meant we'd get hosed down with high-powered apparatus. In this weather, we'd freeze to death if we or our bedding were saturated. It's murder trying to hide in the corner to escape the powerful jet of freezing water. With no panes of glass in the windows, there's nothing to stop it. A lock shuddered and a door opened. "Dinner up!" one of the lads shouted in Gaelic. I abruptly forgot about the high-powered hose and headed towards my little peephole. They were moving down the far side of the wing. I'd get my dinner last, I thought. The plastic plates were piled on top of each other on the trolley. The orderlies were handing them to each cell. B stood breaking off pieces of fish from the plates and was in the process of eating them, and I was raging. "Venian steaks for dinner," B was shouting, and he was laughing at his own sick wit. "I hope they choke on them," said C, putting his little dig in as usual. The food procession moved along with A bringing up the rear. They reached the bottom of the wing and turned. I heard the doors on my side of the wing opening and slamming as they drew nearer. B shouted, "Mr. A, there seems to be a fish short." A sickening feeling hit me right in the chest, almost crippling me. I was the last man. That stinking bastard B ate it. I felt like screaming it out the door, but that was what they wanted me to do. "Ah, Mr. A," said B, "I seem to have made a mistake. There's not a fish missing at all." My heart lifted. "There's two missing, Mr. A." I thought Sean was going to go through the door. I knocked on the wall quickly to remind him that he wasn't on his own. I could hear him cursing them up and down. I felt as sick as the fish must have felt when it was hooked. The most eatable part of the dinner would be missing. It was a catastrophe, and Sean knew it as well as I did. Sean's door opened and closed, then my opened. I stood there as if nothing had occurred. I took the sparse-looking meal from the orderly as A drawled, "We seem to be a few fish short. I shall inform the cookhouse and send them to us as soon as possible." That really meant, "Too bad, you're not getting any." I caught a glimpse of B ceremoniously licking his fingers while wearing that hateful smile of his for the occasion. I turned away from the door, not having uttered a single word or given them any hint of my disgust or dejection. The door slammed like a cannon shot behind me. They all had a jolly good laugh on the way back to their little office, orderlies and all. I sat down and inspected my meager dinner of one unpeeled cold potato and about 30 or 40 odd equally cold and hard peas. The orderlies began their daily session of drumming out and whistling the sash my father wore. B would see them right with a few cigarettes, crack a few sectarian jokes with them, and encourage them to keep up their incessant racket. The orderlies, for their stinking part, crawled right up his sectarian ass and groveled as only informers and rabble can grovel. They'd sell their own mothers for a cigarette. What they did to us for the same price and an easy time of it would make their poor mothers sick. I began to salvage some of the cold dinner, eating as much of it as I could, which was an effort, and throwing the leftovers into a corner with the rest of the filth and rubbish. The sash my father wore ceased, and a few seconds later the cell doors began opening and to the shouts of "collecting the dishes," which echoed along the wing. I began walking, not bothering to have a sly look out the peephole. They continued on their way, collecting the dishes and moving from one cell to the next. I heard Sean telling his neighbor to tell the OC that he was going to ask the screw for a bog roll for toilet paper. The thoughts of my afternoon visit were getting the better of my nervous system. The excitement and just the thought was getting the better of my constipated bowels of 5 days as they began to churn. The party had reached Sean's door. "Any chance of a bit of toilet paper, mister?" asked Sean. "Wipe it with your hand," snapped C, and slammed the door. One and all went into hysterics over C's sick wit. My cell door opened, the orderly removed the plate in the midst of the hilarious uproar. No mention of my missing fish, just bees chirping. "That was a good one, Mr. C," and then more convulsions of laughter. "Ah, no doubt, Mr. C, a cracker, ha ha ha." The door slammed. C delighted in humiliating us. There was an excuse for B. He had the mentality of an idiot. A reveled in it, and the four orderlies competed with each other to win their stinking favor. I rapped on the wall. "Sean," I called, "I'll rig up a line with a bit of towel thread and swing a few tissues to you, Mochara." "Hold on till the screws go for dinner," I added. "May through, Bobby," he said. I sat down to engineer the line, tearing long bits of thread from the towel and twining them together. Just about made C's day, that I thought, working away at my line. "Mr. B, you on night guard tonight?" inquired a screw from the top of the wing. "Yes, that's right," B shouted back from the office. "Ho ho, good or bad?" I asked myself. "He'll be going home now, but he'll be back at 8:30 tonight for the night guard. He'll be drunk." And I knew right away what that meant. "You hear that, Bobby?" shouted Sean. "I heard it, comrade," I answered, thinking Sean had reached the same conclusion as myself. "Trouble tonight." I stood up and lifted a small half-rotten potato from the rubbish and tied it to the end of the completed line to weight it. The office door slammed and the hated keys jingled. "They were going, and good riddance to them," I said, going to the window and tying several tissues to the end of my line. I knocked on the wall. "You there, Sean?" "I'm here, Bobby," he said. "Well, put your hand out and I'll swing these tissues to you," I said. I put my arm out the window and began swinging the weighted line across the 5-foot gap. It hit Sean's hand a few times before he caught hold of it. "I've got you. I've got it, Bobby," he said. "May through, Sean. Take it to you," I said. He pulled the line in and secured the badly needed tissues and then rapped on the wall in acknowledgement. I answered with a knock on the wall and retreated into my thoughts again. What else could I think of but my visit? Seeing my family again. And I'd get a smoke, too. That was something to look forward to. It had been a long, while since I had seen a cigarette, and with a bit of luck I'd have some tonight for myself and the boys. That would be an achievement and a morale booster. My bowels began to churn again. And that's it, I thought. And in a way it was a welcome thought after 5 days of severe constipation. I'm gonna have to go to the toilet. Which sounded a bit ridiculous as I lifted some tissues and retreated to the corner of my cell, which did not afford a view from the spy hatch and the cell door. Despite the relief from constipation, I felt like an animal squatting in the corner of my cell amid rubbish and dirt. But there was nothing else for it. It had to be done, however humiliating and degrading. More so to the lads who were two to a cell, at least I had some privacy. Who among those so-called humanitarians who had kept their silence on the H-blocks, who among them could put a name on this type of humiliation and torture, when men are forced by extreme torture into the position that they had to embark upon a dirt strike to highlight the inhumanity poured upon them? How much must we suffer, I thought. An unwashed body, naked and racked with muscular pain, squatting in a corner, in a den of disease amid piles of putrefying rubbish, forced to defecate upon the ground where the excreta would lie and the smell would mingle with the already sickening evil stench of urine and decaying food waste. Let them find a name for that sort of torture, I thought, rising and moving towards the window to seek fresh air. The beatings, the hosing down, starvation and deprivation, just let them bloody well put a name on this nightmare of nightmares. The drizzle had ceased and the snow remained intact. It was not so cold now, but a chill remained. There were several sparrows trudging about in the snow searching for food, which brought to mind again the fish I never got, nor would ever get. I gathered a few crusts of bread from the floor and flung them out the window to the smaller citizens, the sparrows, and stood watching them pecking their little hearts out. Many an hour I passed at this window just watching the birds, I thought. The sparrows, the starlings, crows and seagulls were my constant companions, and the little wagtails who stayed to entertain me, fluttering about the yard until the last shadows of day departed. They were my only form of entertainment during the long, boring days, and they came every day now since I began throwing the crust of bread out to them. They liked the maggots, I thought, thinking of the sweltering summer months when the cells were like ovens, and the stench from the putrefying piles of rubbish and decaying waste food was almost overwhelming. That was when the white, wriggling, crawling maggots made their way out of the rubbish piles in their thousands. I'll never forget that, I said to myself, reflecting on the morning I woke up and my blankets and mattress were a living mass of white maggots. They were in my hair and beard and crawling upon my naked body. They were repulsive and, dare I say it, frightening at first. But like everything else, I had come to terms with them, sharing my cell with me. At night, I would hear them actually moving about the floor, disturbing little bits of paper now and again, causing a rustling noise as they headed in the direction of my mattress, where they would finally embed themselves and in the warmth, harden into an egg-like cocoon before hatching into flies. They would give off a sharp crack whenever I stood on them with my bare feet in the darkness, squashing them. Needless to say, their end product was a pest, and very annoying. Hundreds of fat, bloated flies that clung to the ceiling and the walls, continually pestering my naked body day and night, hovering around my face as I tried to sleep, or awakening me in the mornings when I would catch a glimpse of a black cloud ascending in panic as I stirred. But the maggots had another use, as I quickly discovered. I soon became so used to them that I would gather them up in my hands off the floor and from the rubbish piles in the corners. There would be thousands of them wriggling and sliding about. Having gathered them together between my palms, I would throw the white wriggling mass out the window, scattering them over the jet black tarmacadam yard and against the black background. Their white wriggling little forms were easily spotted. The wagtails came fluttering about in a frenzy, their quick little legs darting them from one maggot to the next, feasting upon what to them must have been a delicacy. Within 2 or 3 minutes, the yard would be cleared of every single maggot. I suppose it was something to do, to pass the time. Who would believe it if you told them that you spent your summer gathering maggots to feed the birds? I lifted a few crusts of bread from the corner and flung them out the window, remembering my little friends again. Winter was a hard time for the birds, with the snow coating the ground and hiding the land. I went back to my pacing once again as one of the boys shouted, "Ranganoise," summoning the lads to their doors for an Irish language class. The teacher was at the far end of the wing. He began to shout out the lessons at the top of his voice from behind his heavy steel door, asking questions, spelling out words and phrases, while the willing pupils scratched and scribbled them upon the dirty, mutilated walls. It was a rough and rugged way of teaching, but it worked, and everyone endeavored to speak what they had learned all the time until the words and phrases became so common that they were used instinctively. The Irish class continued in the background as I returned to my thoughts, thinking of how they would be getting ready in the house now to come up on the afternoon visit, if they weren't on their way already. They were probably as excited as I was, wishing the time away. It would be a long, hard day for them, waiting and queuing, being herded about like cattle from one gate to the next, from one degrading search to another, enduring the insults and despising dirty glances from the screws before they finally reached the visit box. Then they would have to go through it all over again to get out. A screw began jeering and shouting from the top of the wing, trying to disrupt the ongoing Gaelic class, but the lads continued, disregarding him. It happened all the time. The screws, achieving nothing, soon got fed up and departed. I sat down upon the mattress again, my body still sore, the bruises coloring more as each hour passed by. I was very tired, becoming easily exhausted, not having had exercise or fresh air for so long, and I was bored stiff. The thought of my afternoon visit left me barely able to think. "But there's always someone worse off than yourself," I told myself, remembering all too well my dead comrades and their families. "At least I can see you once a month," my mother would say. "Better where you are than in Milltown Cemetery." But then there were times when Milltown would have been the preferable alternative, when things became so unbearable that you just couldn't care less whether you lived or died, just as long as you could escape the hellish nightmare. "Aren't we dying anyway?" I thought. "Aren't our bodies degenerating to a standstill? I am a living corpse now. What will I be like in 6 months' time? Will I even be alive after another year?" I used to worry about that, churning it around in my mind for hours on end. But no more. Because that is the only thing left that they can do to me. Kill me. I have known this for some time, and God knows that it isn't for the want of trying that they haven't achieved that on some one of us yet. But I am determined that I shall never give up. They can do what they will with me, but I will never bow to them or allow them to criminalize me. I find it startling to hear myself say that I am prepared to die first rather than succumb to their oppressive torture, and I know that I am not on my own, and that my comrades hold the same. And I thought of my dead comrades again, my friends who had stood beside me one day and were dead the next. Boys and girls just like myself, born and raised in the nationalist ghettos of Belfast to be murdered by foreign soldiers and lackey sectarian thugs. How many have been murdered at their hands throughout the occupied 6 counties? Too many. One boy or girl was one too many. How many more Irish people would die? How many more lives would be lost before the British had decided that they had murdered enough and were forced to get out of Ireland forever? Inside and outside of jail, it was all the same. Oppression bearing down upon you from every direction. Every street corner displaying an armed British soldier. Every street having endured its share of suffering and grief at their hands. I was proud to be resisting, to be fighting back. They couldn't defeat us outside. They are torturing us unmercifully inside their hell holes and have failed to defeat us again. I was frightened, But I knew I would never give up. I would face the imperial might of their entire torturous arsenal rather than succumb. I tugged at my blankets to wrap them around me and rolled over, hoping to doze for a while. The screws would not be back until after 2 o'clock. B would be back at 8:30 p.m. tonight, and I wondered who would be his replacement in the meantime. I'll find out soon enough, I thought, closing my eyes and my mind to my surroundings.
There's an inner thing in every man. Do you know this thing, my friend? It has withstood the blows of a million years and will do so to the end. It was born when time did not exist, and it grew up out of life. It cut down evil, strangling veins like a slicing, searing knife. It lit fires when fires were not, and burnt the mind of men, tempering leaden hearts to steel from the time that time began. It wept by the waters of Babylon, and when all men were a loss, it screeched in writhing agony, and it hung bleeding from the cross. It died in Rome by land and sword in defiant, cruel array, when the deathly word was Spartacus along the Appian Way. It marched with Wat the tailors poor, and frightened lord and king, and it was emblazoned in their deathly stir as ear a living thing. It smiled in holy innocence before conquistadors of old, so meek and tame and unaware of the deathly power of gold. It burst forth through pitiful Paris streets and stormed the old Bastille and marched upon the serpent's head and crushed it neath its heel. It died in blood on buffalo plains and starved by moons of rain. Its heart was buried in wounded knee, but it will come to rise again. It screamed along by Kerry Lakes as it knelt upon the ground, and it died in great defiance as they coldly shut it down. It has found in every light of hope, it knows no bounds nor space. It has risen in red and black and white, it is there in every race. It lies in the hearts of heroes dead, it screams in tyrants' eyes. It has reached the peaks of mountain high, it comes searing across the skies. It lights the dark of this prison cell, it thunders forth its might. It is the undauntable thought, my friend, that thought that says I'm right.
Slop out on the air, slop out on the air. I awoke with a jump. Slop out in the air. The tin bucket clambered and rattled, and a cold chill swept through my body, leaving an empty, hollow sensation in the pit of my stomach. I rose quickly but wearily, dreading the thought of a cramp. I was okay, although for several seconds my eyes fought to clear the blackness of a light head and threatening blackout. I defeated it and sprang to my peephole at the door. The door next to Pee-wee's cell opened. A, B, and C's replacement, D, stood in a semicircle around the entrance, the four groveling orderlies flanking them, one clutching a squeegee. John O'Brien stepped into the doorway, his blanket hanging around him, and emptied his chamber pot of urine onto the ground in the wing, then stepped back into the cell. The orderly with the squeegee needed no signal. He stepped forward and brushed the pool of urine back into the cell again, all around John O'Brien's mattress. Most of the lads were lashing the contents of their pose under the doors, using an empty pot to push the urine that remained out into the wing. The bottom of my door was too tight. There was a large gap at the top and the side, but too awkward for this type of operation. I would have to take the hard way out and heave it into the wing as John O'Brien had done when my door was opened. It had to be done. If they got the pool of urine in your cell, it would end up all over you and your bedding. There's more than one way to skin a cat, or, in our case, more than one way to try to break a prisoner of war, and this was a well-worn one. They were switching cells, going from one side of the wing to the other. It didn't matter whose door they opened. It was just another harassment exercise. It built up to more torture. I grabbed the pole and stood poised for action. Better if I had a cellmate, I thought, wishing for moral support. But Sean was on his own as well, and so was poor Pee-wee this morning. They were going to get someone else. I could sense that this was the whole object of the slop-out, and we all knew that only too well. My lock rattled, alerting me. I stood poised and ready, poe in hand, hoping for the best. The door opened. I didn't even glance at them. I lowered the pole towards the ground, jettisoning the contents in the middle of the maneuver, hoping none would splash around their stinking, shining boots. I stepped back, lifting my head, expecting a blow that never came. I glanced at their faces. C and D were steaming drunk. A was grinning as usual. The orderly appeared and began to brush the reeking mess back into my cell, saturating the sides and bottom of my mattress before he decided to retreat. The door slammed. I lifted my mattress and began to squeeze the urine out of the filthy foam onto the floor. I then started to scrape and push the pool towards the bottom of the door. It was a long, slow process. The door was tight and narrow. The urine trickled out slowly. In the wing, the slop-out continued. The bucket rattled, spelling out danger. The occasional splash announced another emptied po. The tension was almost sickening. Then it happened. A sudden eruption of noise, shouts, yells, and venom-filled screams. The bucket clambered onto the ground, and a barrage of dull thuds carried along the wing. What sounded like someone's head colliding with the steel pipes came ringing through the cells. I dropped my pole and put my eye to the peephole, hearing a voice scream, "Give them more!" The ruckus continued until I heard A shout, "That's enough!" Several screws came tearing down the wing from the opposite direction, their heavy boots squelching and splashing in the pools of reeking urine that lay on the corridor floor. "Get a van for the punishment cells!" screamed D in his hateful, ignorant voice. "Get a van for the punishment cells." There were more thuds and banging, then footsteps and evil laughter, followed by the gradual build-up of running feet, bumping, and what sounded like the swish of water. Four black uniforms darted past my area of vision, dragging a naked body by the feet, his back scraping and scratching the ground and his head bumping off the concrete. It passed so quickly that I was unable to recognize who it was. But there had been blood on his face and body, whoever he was. For several seconds, nothing stirred. A sinister, expectant silence resumed. The pools of urine rippled and weighed, then settled into a calm pool, just as the same noises built up again. The speedy build-up of feet gaining speed, the thuds, the bangs, and swish. And another massive black figure soared past my line of vision, dragging another blood-stained body by the feet. The swish died away, and the squeaks of the naked body burning as it reached and contacted dry, shiny surface at the end of the wing faded. The sinister silence resumed its ugly roll. Tension hung like a guillotine. No one dared to breathe aloud, fearing it would fall upon them. It was soul-destroying and seemingly endless. A scream came, shrieking and hurtling down the wing. "Chakiala!" bounced and rebounded in frightening echoes off the walls, shattering the silence, like an impact of a brick crashing through a window, raising hearts, bitterness, and hate riveted to every single syllable. "Our day will come!" That's what it meant, and our day would come, I told myself, and God help you, A, C, and D, and you too, B, and every stinking last one of you, because you were all the same, torture mongers. "Chakiala!" I screamed out the door. One of the boys down at the end of the wing began to sing, "A Nation Once Again." "A Nation Once Again" resounded and echoed from behind every door, and everyone joined in to break that ungodly silence, lifting our spirits and bolstering our shaken morale. The stench from the reeking urine streamed in through the door, flooding my eyes with tears and catching the back of my throat. The orderlies attempted a rendering of the sash, but were drowned out with an explosion of noise as the now empty pose rattled and battered the scarred doors in defiance and anger. "Chalk Yarla, all right," I said. "The sooner the better." I went back to my task of getting rid of the small remaining pool of urine at my feet, pushing it out under the door. The noise began to die away as the last drops of urine disappeared in a trickle out the door. I threw the pole into the corner upon the rubbish and sat down on my mattress, my feet avoiding the damp area, my mind in turmoil, exhausted and strained, begging relief and comfort that was never granted. The noise died completely. Sean rapped on the wall, concerned as ever. "All right, Bobby," he called. "I'm all right, Sean. What about yourself?" They didn't even come into my cell," he replied. "Who was dragged out?" I asked. "I don't know," he said, adding that he had sent down a line to find out. "But I think C and D did all the beating," he said. "They probably did," I offered an agreement. "Hey, Sean," one of the lads shouted up the line. "It was Liam Clark and Sean Hughes. C and D did most of the beating. The orderly with the squeegee beat the two lads stupid with the pole. No reason, Sean. Same as usual. They pounced on them and they were turning back into the cell." I left Sean to discuss with the lads at the windows what had happened and began walking the floor once again, keeping in mind that I would be called for my visit at any minute. The beating up of two lads and Pee-wee O'Donnell earlier had temporarily dampened my enthusiasm. I couldn't help but think of them lying there now on the boards in the punishment block, where they probably got another brutal beating at the hands of the sadistic screws who appropriately managed that torture center within a torture center. I knew only too well what it was like in there. It was dreaded by one and all. The punishment block stood for torture, brutality, and inhumanity. Even the screws knew it, but would not say. I spent 3 days there a few months ago, three of the longest and most unbearable days of my entire life. The screws removed me from my cell naked, and I was conveyed to the punishment block in a blacked-out van. As I stepped out of the van on arrival, there they grabbed me from all sides and began punching and kicking me to the ground. Not one single word had been spoken, not even so much as a threat. I was a Republican blanket man, and that was all the go-ahead that was needed. I barely realized what had occurred or what was happening as they dragged me by my hair across a stretch of hardcore rubble to the gate of the punishment block. One of them rang the bell to summon the screw inside to come out and open the gate to admit them. I lay at their feet, dazed, shocked, and panting for breath. My heart was pounding and my body felt it was on fire, torn to ribbons by the rough concrete that had cut and hacked at my naked skin. My face was warm and wet from the blood spurting from a gash on my head. I lay stock still, playing possum, hoping they'd be content thinking that I was unconscious. My cheek rested on the cold, hard black surface, but my body was unaware of the biting cold. I mumbled a Hail Mary to myself in a hurried act of contrition as I heard the approaching jingle of keys. Several gloved hands gripped and tightened around my arms and feet, raising my body off the ground and swinging me backwards in one movement. The full weight of my body recoiled forward again, smashing my head against the corrugated iron covering the gate. The sky seemed to fall upon me as they dropped me to the ground. The second impact sent a mass of tiny white stars exploding in front of my eyes like fireworks display that suddenly became extinguished by a cloud of inky blackness. I regained consciousness lying on the floor of one of the cells of the punishment block. I opened my eyes. My head was reeling. The bright light in the ceiling spiraled downwards and blinded me. The pain in my head was enormous and sickening. My whole body was seized by crippling pains and aches. I lay transfixed on the ground, afraid to move, the taste of blood on my swollen lips, fighting to work out where I was and what had happened. The concrete floor was intensely cold, and I knew I would have to get up off it or pay the consequences of perhaps pneumonia later. I rose slowly to my knees first. The walls came hurtling towards me. I fell. After an eternity, I tried again. Through spasms of pain, almost rendered my body useless. I made it to my knees. My skin was burning as the raw flesh from the massive cuts and scrapes clung to the cold floor. I got up. I made it to my feet. I almost fell again, but with the aid of the wall, I staggered to the concrete block that served as a stool and slumped upon it. I felt as if I was dying. I was so distracted by pain and shock that I didn't know what to do. I simply couldn't think. The slightest movement of my body sent me shivering and gasping in agony. I was on the point of screaming out when the cell door opened, revealing a white-coated figure of an orderly who stepped into the cell. The glorified screw with the white coat began to examine me, fiddling about my body, poking and probing, imitating the antics of a doctor, trying to impress the audience of screws who stood around the entrance to the cell. Having made his observations, or whatever he had done, he arrogantly informed me that to see a doctor and receive treatment, I would firstly have to bathe. I glared at him in disbelief. He repeated what he had said, only in a sterner, threatening voice. He knew what he was doing. He knew that I was hurt and in need of immediate attention. But he was putting me under duress, holding me to ransom. No bath, no treatment. Besides, I was so sore I could barely move, let alone bathe. And I hadn't any intention of breaking my protest. Hurt or dying, I was not going to concede to him or anyone else. I knew what was coming. His ultimatum changed to a command. "Drop dead," I said angrily. The hovering press gang without so much as a "where are you hurt?" and without any ceremony lifted me as a man would lift a bundle of rags and carried me to the already full bath, dropping me into the water like a bar of soap. The shock of the ice-cold water engulfing my tattered body almost stopped my breath. Every part of me stung unmercifully as the heavy disinfected water attacked my naked raw flesh. I made an immediate and brave attempt to rise out of the freezing, stinging water, but the screws held me down while one of them began to scrub my already tattered back with a heavy scrubbing brush. I shriveled with the pain and struggled for release, but the more I fought, the more they strengthened their iron grip. The tears came, flooding my eyes. I would have screamed had I been able to catch my breath. They continued to scrub every part of my tortured body, pouring buckets of ice-cold water and soapy liquid over me. I vaguely remember being lifted out of the cold water. The sadistic screw had grabbed my testicles and scrubbed my private parts. That was the last thing I remembered. I collapsed. I was taken to the prison hospital wrapped in a large fawn blanket where the doctor examined me. I remained there for 2 hours and patched up like a mummy, sporting a black eye and 7 stitches in my head. I was returned to my punishment cell. I sat there wrapped in a solitary filthy blanket that reeked of urine and stale smoke. I had regained my composure, although I was a little disoriented, and still trying to piece together my awful ordeal. But that soon became overshadowed by the thoughts of what was to come. No one could do anything for me. I could not tell a soul, as I was isolated, alone, and vulnerable. I was simply at their mercy, and I had already discovered and learned that they did not know the meaning of the word. Perhaps worst of all, I was freezing cold, unable to walk and exercise and warm myself, and I was feeling sorry for myself. The screws came back later in the day and once again dragged me out of the cell to appear naked before a prison governor to be tried in the normal, farcical court. I stood naked before them, humiliated and embarrassed, my head bursting with the pain of my earlier beating. I was charged with disobeying an order, that is, refusing to cooperate with the screw who was endeavoring to probe and search my anal passage. In other words, I refused point blank to allow this. But I was charged because it took 3 or 4 of them to hold me down to do it. The screw in question had been the white-coated one. It would have made little difference to me had he been a brain surgeon, as the motive was purely to degrade and humiliate me, which was all part of the general torture to break our resistance. I was found guilty, not that I expected anything else, and sentenced to 3 days to be spent in the punishment cells, to be fed on what was politely termed a number one diet, a starvation diet. I also lost 1 month's remission, the equivalent of a two-month prison sentence. To wrap things up nicely, I was charged with assaulting the four screws who had almost murdered me that morning, and to rub it in, I was also charged with causing self-inflicted wounds to myself and informed in a roundabout way that if I dared to make a formal complaint, I would also be charged with making false allegations against prison officers. How can you win? I thought, and felt like vomiting as they dragged me back to my cell again, being remanded to appear before the Board of Visitors. I would be there 3 days, then back at the end of the month for another 15 days. The BOV would ensure that. The cell was freezing cold, bare, and lonely. I'd been here once before, therefore I knew how lonely and unbearable it would get. A board on the concrete floor served as my bed, a concrete slab as a table, and a concrete block as a stool. A Bible, Poe, and water container were the only other visible items. I remained there for the 3 days, being beaten up twice more, but not as severely as the initial hiding I'd received. When the filth of the Poe needed to be emptied, they attempted to hold me for ransom. Put on prison clothes to empty it, they said. I refused. So it spilled over to the cell floor and lay there. I plodded through it regardless. I had to get warm. My body was continuously numb. For the first 2 days, I was barely able to walk at all, and I was growing weaker as the starvation diet took its toll. My daily food consisted of 2 slices of bread, dry and stale, and a mug of black lukewarm tea for breakfast. Then for dinner, I had a small bowl of watery soup. My evening tea was the same as breakfast. On the 3rd day, I collapsed again and lay on the cold concrete floor, regaining consciousness sometime later of my own accord. When I returned to H Block, even the screws stared in shock at my death-like appearance. I was physically wrecked and mentally exhausted. The starvation, beatings, forcible bathing, the boredom and cold remained in my mind, scarring me deeply with hatred, bitterness, and thoughts of revenge. 2 weeks later, I endured another 15 days there. It was the same nightmare, only multiplied by 5. I lived like an insane animal, eating with my hands. Every other 3 days, they starved me, and once again I plodded through the dirt and filth, exercising to keep warm, taking the beatings, praying to myself, crying in my sleep, always fighting the urge to give in to them, to surrender. But I survived. I beat them again. The torturous dungeons and the sadists who manned them had destroyed my body, but it failed to break my spirit. It was 3 weeks later before I recovered from my torturous ordeal. My mind will never recover from it. God only knows how many of us have been subjected to that nightmare. Poor Pee-wee and the other 2 lads will be going through it all right now. How many more will be subjected to it, and how long can it go on before someone is beaten to death, I wondered. Where is it all going to end, I asked myself, sitting down upon my mattress again.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lives of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me, the Bill of Rights throws me in jails, they all know me. Frustrated are churchmen, the saving of soul men, the tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull and leap on me, they're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the light. silly civil servants. They thrive off my body. Their trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. Police, they arrest me. Materialists test me. Pollution, it chokes me. Movies, they joke me. Politicians exploit me. City life that jades me. Hudson Bay fleets me. Hunting laws freak me. Government is bumbling. Revolution's rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition continuity. I pity the country. I pity the state. And the mind of a man who thrives on hate.